This is the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On, board-certified clinical sexologist, and Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. Xander will do the honors and introduce our guest this hour.
Yes, thank you, On. Our guest today is Dr. Dana Beyer. Dr. Beyer will be discussing the broad aspects of Nick Confessore's essay in the New York Times. Welcome to the show, Dr. Beyer.
Thank you very much, Xander. Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Why don't we just get started? What was this essay about that Nick Confessore wrote?
It's interesting how we were so successful from, say, the early 90s up until the Bostock decision in 2020, where the Supreme Court ruled that employment discrimination against trans people was illegal under Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And we had been making that progress relatively quietly because everything was about gay marriage and all the focus was on gay marriage and all that stuff. And that reached its peak in 2015 with the Obergefell decision from the Supreme Court. And then when people started paying attention to the trans community, and I will define terms later, I'm using the broadly accepted terms now, when they finally started paying attention to the trans community after all the celebrations in 2015 were over, they noticed a trans movement that was radically different from the trans movement of which I had been a part since the early 90s. And Nick had also been aware of this, but because of the election in 2016 and then the response to it, which became called the resistance, and the 4 years of the first Trump administration, a lot of this stuff got submerged and people didn't pay attention. And there was very little that was published in mainstream media. The one really big story that was published was Jesse Singel's story in The Atlantic. You may have heard of Jesse. We've become friends. We communicate quite a bit. He's a very good researcher. He knows how to read papers and determine whether something is statistically valid or not, which is a skill that many people don't have. Certainly many people who don't have statistical or biostatistical skills, where it's critical. So that was about it. And he got excoriated for that, but that was the Me Too era, and people were all worked up on a bunch of other things. And then COVID happened, and that shifted everything. The pandemic led to George Floyd, and everybody's locked down, and everybody's going crazy. And it was only until, I guess, 2021, maybe early 2022, where the trans movement came back into public view and the media started covering it. I remember an episode where a bunch of trans engineers at Netflix went out demonstrating about a trans genocide. You're nodding, so apparently you remember that too. And I remember thinking about how just superficially, so these kids are, most of them were Zoomers or millennials, I guess. So there's young adults. They're getting paid six figures, probably 200, maybe 300K a piece. And they're screaming that they're being genocided and stuff. And I thought, this is bizarre. What's going on here? And also for me, back in 2021, my last organization that I led was called Gender Rights Maryland. And we succeeded in getting a gender identity bill passed in Maryland in 2014 after getting a bunch of county level bills passed before that. And we basically shut down in 2018 after we managed to implement it. And my board chair, a woman named Sharon Brackett, one of my best friends, passed away in the spring of 2021. And that was during COVID spring. And I remember recognizing that, oh, this is tough. You know, we had just come out of the worst of the pandemic and people were going out and they were going out to restaurants and stuff. And I decided I needed to get away and I needed to go home to New York and be with friends. So I met some of my oldest friends from elementary school and high school. And we're having dinner and we're enjoying being out finally after a year, basically. And at the end of each of those meals, there were three of them, they said, Dana, I know you don't want to talk about this. You've done this your whole life and everything, but I got to tell you, you remember my nephew who was such and such and such? Well, now my nephew says they're now my niece, or my niece is now getting a double mastectomy in a month. What do I do? It hit me like the tsunami we were talking about earlier from Kamchatka. It just all of a sudden, where did this come from? This was in my family, my extended family. There had been parents during the lockdown who had called and said, oh my God, my kid is on TikTok and Tumblr and Reddit and all that, and is deciding that they are non-binary or they're trans and all that. I got them through that during the lockdown. And I said, these kids are not a majority. They're less than 18. They're in high school, basically, most of them. Just calm them down. By the time this thing ends and they go back to school, most of it will pass. And for the most part, it did. But then this happened in 2021, and I went, oh, I guess I better pay more attention to this. So I started doing research on it. And I saw how the movement had basically gone off the tracks because it was, I'll use a blunt term, hijacked by the queer community. And I've been making this case. I'm not public anymore. After the Bostock decision, I decided to retire. That was the culmination of all the public advocacy and political work that I had done for 25 years. I led the campaign or co-led the campaign to get the DSM changed in 2009. And that was finally completed in 2013 and stuff. And I helped write the language in there, which now is archaic. It doesn't make any sense that I look at that. Why did I use that term, like gender incongruence? What is that? Oh, the queer movement hijacked the language. They hijacked the movement. They hijacked the success of the movement. Not a stupid political act, by the way. You build on success. And if you can convince people that you're just the next best thing, particularly when a lot of older people feel guilty for not having been on the gay rights bandwagon back in the 20th century and, you know, treating their kids badly and then AIDS and all that, then you're going to win and you're going to win quickly. So they were smart in the way they handled it. But what most people didn't recognize is that this was not the transsexual movement. These people were not transsexual. These were not the people that we were getting medical help for and trying to improve medical care with better surgeons, better understanding of hormones, greater insurance coverage. We had accomplished all of that. And in 2020, we reached the pinnacle with the Bostock decision saying, yeah, you can't discriminate against trans people. One of the funny stories about that is there were three plaintiffs in the Bostock decision. One was a trans woman, Amy Stevens, and then there were two gay guys. And the gay guys were sort of afterthoughts, but the court decided to lump them all together because it was an employment discrimination thing, and they both had gay, trans, and put it together and stuff. When I was chairman of the board of Freedom to Work back in 2012 or 2013, I created a slogan called No Gay Left Behind. Because up to that point, and throughout the teens, the trans movement won all of its Circuit Court of Appeals decisions, but won. We just kept winning. The gay community never won an appeals court decision until 2017. We kept winning all along. So we were the lead in the Bostock case. It was about a trans woman, transsexual woman, as it turns out. This definition is now more important. Again, we're going back to the future, so to speak. And we needed to bring the gay community with us because the gay community had never won a major federal court of appeals decision on employment discrimination. We won because of sex, the phrase because of sex, which was implanted in the 1964 Civil Rights Act in Title VII in an effort to kill it. Inadvertently, it created basically the women's movement on steroids. And we took advantage of that. And that's the way we worked in the legal advocacy community for decades, actually. And it culminated in the Supreme Court in 2020. What the queer community did, and the queer community is, you can decide what you think about it, but it's a revolutionary movement. It was not a movement to get people who are different in a different form as part integrated into society. It was a movement to undermine society, to change society, to remake society, to re-engineer society. Gay people just wanted to be like their straight brothers and sisters. Their straight brothers and sisters got married. They wanted to get married. They could serve in the military. They wanted to serve in the military. They weren't asking for special rights. They were asking for equal rights. I probably, even looking back on it, spent far more time working for gay rights than I did for trans rights because there were far more gay people than trans people. And there was far more interest in gay rights, certainly up until recently, than for trans rights. So we did that. And we were attacked like, oh, you want special rights? And we would say, no, we're comfortable saying, no, we don't want special rights. We just want to be treated the way everybody else is treated. And we managed to accomplish that. And I think when people look back on it, they say, you know, that the gay rights movement was the most remarkably successful and quick civil rights movement in world history. I mean, it happened so quickly, right? And it's because gay people were simply asking for the same stuff that everybody else had. So it's not a real lift for non-gay people, for straight people to just say, yeah, okay, yeah, why not? And that's what trans people wanted too. All we wanted was better healthcare, access for everybody for healthcare. And then once we transition, not to be denied employment, denied promotion, or fired simply because of the fact that we had transitioned. It was that simple. It was basically, we were the kid sisters of our gay brothers, and we just wanted to come along. We were the caboose of the gay train, and we were just coming along, and they viewed us this way too. It's why I'm using that as the metaphor. But just treat us the same way. And as a physician, I was uniquely positioned because I think I was the only activist slash advocate who was actually an MD who could come out and say, all we want is recognition that we have this congenital sexual developmental variation, and we want to be treated like anybody else with a congenital variation that needs medical care. That's all this is about. That's all it ever was about. And in those days, we were known as transsexual. That goes back to the 50s and the 60s when the German sexologists moved to the U.S. pre-war in the 30s when they were chased out of Nazi Germany. And then they set up and slowly built up practices, Harry Benjamin, the lead in New York, doing that. And transsexual became the term of use. And I think it's fair to say that everybody from Lily Elbe, the Danish girl back in the 20s, on forward, at least until 2010, maybe, or something, everybody, with very few exceptions, who transitioned, called themselves transsexual, thought of themselves as transsexual, knew they were different from the very beginning, trapped in the wrong body. That was the slogan. And it was a pretty good slogan because you had certain body parts that were of one sex and other body parts that were the other sex. They didn't match. And so you had to deal with it. And if your brain was of the opposite sex, that gave you the gender dysphoria, the discomfort with your body and such. That's not considered politically correct to say today, in the wrong body and such, but virtually all of the transsexual people that I knew, and I got to know a lot of them over the course of 30 years, not only used that story, they weren't trying to con therapists and endocrinologists and surgeons, they literally believed that. Now, I have subsequently learned over the past few years that there are a couple of people out there who pose as transsexuals and who've embraced that identity, who really weren't, who would acknowledge today. Corinna Cohen is one of the famous ones. She has a podcast and she's on Twitter and stuff, who admits that she's really a gay guy who was afraid of getting AIDS back in the late 80s and decided transitioning would be the easiest way to prevent that from happening. So she basically went the route of the Islamic Republic of Iran, where the choice was you're either going to be a gay man and be thrown off the roof, or we're going to make you into a simulacrum of a woman and you can live that way and have whatever sex you want with a man. That was her decision. And I know there are trans men who had a similar decision. They were tired of being abused as butch lesbians, and they decided, well, I will do this. That was the norm. And I think everybody recognized that in all the legislative work that we did and all the legal work that we did, we all used the same understanding of who we were. And we said that I would often get questions at Maryland State Legislature. Well, what if you wake up on Monday and you think you're a girl, and then on Wednesday you think you're a boy? What do we do then? Nobody does that. That's just not a thing. We've known this our entire lives. We don't flip-flop like that. You have to be persistent, consistent, and insistent. You've heard that three-word phrase. And that was true of virtually everybody. Of course, there are always exceptions, but virtually everybody believed that. And that was the norm throughout the aughts and into the early teens. I was the medical director of the Bethesda PFLAG support group, one of the first trans support groups in the country. And PFLAG was, I think, the first gay rights organization that decided to open themselves up to trans people and to help the parents of trans kids back in the late 90s. And so I saw parents and some kids come in over two decades, and I watched the change, the hijacking by the queer community. Now, mind you, most of these people were not active hijackers. They had been hijacked by the queer community and come to believe that this is who they were because of the influence of social media. And when you read about this, you see that most of this began in 2012 with Tumblr, where the language started coming into social media and was all over the internet. And then TikTok came along and things got worse. By 2015, it was pretty prevalent in society. But I watched the parents of these kids, most of whom were transsexual during the aughts, suddenly we got parents of autistic kids. Suddenly parents of grown kids, their young adult children in their late 20s, early 30s, were coming out and saying, oh, I'm trans. And there had been no gender nonconformity. Nothing had been said during their childhood or their adolescence. It's an interesting phenomenon to have watched that. And I remember saying, we don't know. I personally don't know. These are the first autistic kids, mostly on the spectrum, not severely autistic kids, but it's amazing what they've even done with severely autistic kids in certain clinics. But for the most part, they were on the spectrum and they were mostly loners and they stayed in their room. And then when the internet came along, they could do that and their parents allowed them to do that and such. And I watched this evolution so that by the time the pandemic hit in 2019, 2020, most of the parents were parents of kids that I didn't recognize from the early teens, the aughts, and the 90s. These were not transsexual kids. We didn't use the word transsexual anymore, mind you. I was part of the national political movement. And I remember that we recognized that the gay community was smart enough to abandon homosexual. And why? Because homosexual has the word sex in homosexual. And when you say homosexual, the first thing that any non-homosexual goes to, so that's what people think. And when I started lecturing publicly about this stuff, and I would explain the biology of sex and gender and all that, I'd have people open it up to questions. Like the first three questions are, so what do you do in bed? Who's your partner in bed? What's the sex like? Okay, I'll tell you about that. I'm not embarrassed to talk about anything, but that's not what this is about. Being trans is about who you are, not about to whom you're attracted, right? We all know this stuff, but we had to teach it. And we had to teach it so we could persuade people to take us seriously and recognize us who we were. So that gay community got rid of homosexual. And then we decided, well, transsexual leads to the same visions in people's minds. They're worrying, they're wondering about how we do our sex, and we must all be florists and hairdressers, the same kind of stuff that they threw at the gay community. We don't need this. So what are we going to do? So the first effort was, well, let's go to transgender. But of course, Virginia Prince, who was a crossdresser and wrote books about this, was saying, no, crossdressers are transgender. You're not transgender. You're transsexual. You know, you people are crazy. You actually want to change your bodies. We don't want to do that. We just want to prance around. But the movement went to transgender, even though it has that Germanic sounding in it, and was very unpalatable and it didn't really scale well, but people did that. But then I realized with a couple of others in the mid-aughts that, you know, what really worked for gay was not only getting rid of sex from homosexual, was getting a single syllable, three-letter word. Made it much easier. And it was a very positive, uplifting word. We didn't have that, but we had trans. We could just truncate it to trans. And we expanded in the early aughts, we expanded the umbrella. Anybody who wants to be part of our community, because we were so few, we were what, 0.3% of the population, 0.4% of the population. Male crossdressers are 10% of the male population, but they weren't really interested. They come to conferences and party and stuff. It gave them an excuse to get dressed up and be with other transsexual people who are actually living 24/7. But we needed to broaden it so we had more numbers that would show up at hearings. So it wasn't just one person saying, please change the law to protect me. And of course, I met legislators who said, well, that would be perfectly fine, but that wouldn't work. You know, it's not the way politics works. So we went to trans and we widened the umbrella. But by 2014 and 2015, it was pretty clear. I used to write a weekly column for the Huffington Post for 6 years. And I wrote something about the tearing of the trans umbrellas. It got too large. And we had all sorts of people that wanted to be a part of it, that they were narcissistic. They felt important. They can be part of the umbrella. They can be part of a team. They weren't really gay, or maybe they were gay, but gays had succeeded. They wanted to be a part of it. And so we opened it up, and inadvertently opening the door up allowed the queers to come in. And then the queers came in and took it over and redefined it. You could trans is whatever you want it to be. If you look at the medical literature, you will see one paper that talks about transgender clients, and another one talks about trans clients, and another one talks about trans non-binary clients, and another one talks about transgender non-binary clients, and another one talks about transgender non-conforming, TGNC, TGNB, TNB, all of these things. They can't define the term because there is no definition. This is the concept of self-ID. And a lot of people, a lot of transsexual people, to be fair, again, a lot of this is understandable how it evolved, but it fell off the rails. A lot of transsexual people didn't like having to jump through hoops and go to two therapists and two shrinks and have them recognize that, yes, you are who you say you are and who you've been since you were 3 years old. Right? Nobody likes that, certainly as an adult.
You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. Our guest this hour is Dr. Dana Beyer, who is discussing the broader aspects of Nick Confessori's essay in the New York Times. We are going to take our first commercial break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato.
Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle Magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg, and our guest is Dr. Dana Beyer. We hope that you're enjoying it. Let's get back to the show.
But it was taken to an extreme, first in Britain and then here, that anybody who says that they're trans is trans. And so trans no longer means what it used to mean. It means anybody who says they're trans is trans. It doesn't mean transsexual anymore. You ask anybody what gender dysphoria means, they can't define that. They can't define gender identity anymore. That language varies all the time. It is basically open season. Anybody can do anything, which may be okay, except that it generally, to use the old phrase that my parents liked, was it takes two to tango. And you can identify any which way you want. You may be, if you're a gay man, you may be a bear, or a leather guy, or a twink, or whatever. There are all these sub-communities. And in the trans community now, you could look at it, there are all these multiple trans communities. How many gender identities are there? There are 100 plus. I lost count. And I would go to conferences, beginning in 2015 at a WPATH conference, where Joanna Olson Kennedy, Joanna Olson at the time, I think, was bragging about how her kids were so creative and they came up with so many new gender identities. And it was like 50 at the time. And then I remember it passed 100. And now I think they claim 72 because that's what they settled on, just the way 41% of trans people attempt suicide. That was a question in the first National Trans Discrimination Study in 2008, very poorly worded question. I was on the board of NCTE at the time that we did that. We didn't have experts who knew about suicide, how to frame the question and be precise and all that. Yet everybody today in 2025 will say 41%. That number has a life of its own. So we made a mistake back then and it refuses to die. It's the zombie suicide number.
One of the things that I've always found really interesting is this ongoing tension between gender identity disorder, and then gender dysphoria within the APA Diagnostic Statistics Manual of Mental Diseases and Disorders. We needed that in order to get access to medical treatment. right, as transsexuals. The push against that was, I don't have a mental illness. I didn't want to be labeled with a psychiatric diagnosis. Even as a medical social worker, I had some resistance to that when I first started my transition 20 years ago. Nowadays, people will say, oh, you don't need gender dysphoria to be trans. There's all these different stories that are going along as you're talking about all the different identities and the different sub-communities or subcultures. But there is this ongoing tension, which is the people who say, I want medical treatment, like I want hormones and or surgeries, but I don't want a diagnosis. But that's not how the system works. The insurance company needs a code to approve things and for billing and reimbursement. So that's like the technical part that maybe they don't need to know about. But there is this argument that there is a medical diagnosis, there's medical treatment versus I don't have a diagnosis, but I want these things, but they're talking as if surgeries and hormones are outside of a medical context. Like they're just talking about them as this broader thing. I want to transition. Well, what do you mean by that? Oh, I want to take cross-sex hormones or what they may call HRT or gender-affirming hormones. That requires a prescription from a prescriber, which is typically going to be an MD, DO, NP, PA. And you can't just go to a pharmacy in our country and get medication without a prescription like you can in some other countries, or even through mail order without a type of prescription for compounding. So it's this interesting tension. It's funny because you're a doctor, Ann's a nurse, I'm a medical social worker. We understand the system and we understand medicine, and these conversations are outside of it. They've become, like you said, the queerness. So they've politicized them. They've tried to remove them from medicine while demanding medical care and medical treatment, or what they call gender-affirming care. And I just want to say one thing really quickly before you respond to that, which is we had Jonathan Rauch on the show not that long ago from the Brookings Institute. And he, along with Andrew Sullivan and some other people, they recognized the queer rights movement from the 90s and how it was going to derail the things that the gay rights movement wanted. And so they re-steered the conversation. And I said then, and I've been saying it for a while now, for a few years, I think we are there now. Do we need a similar reclaim the narrative, steer it in a different direction, a more liberal direction versus a more queer direction?
Yes. And well, I think so. Well, you read the article, you read Nick's article, and I spent a lot of time talking to him, giving him the backstory. It's an extended version of what I'm doing with you today. We spent many more than 1 hour talking about this, but most importantly, I referred him to a bunch of other players from the 90s, the aughts, and the teens and such, and the 20s, who could speak to this. Brianna Wu, who's quoted in his piece twice, I believe, is one of those people who's trying to do this. She just had vocal cord surgery because she's been losing her voice like I am, but I'm 35 years older than she is. So it's like, you know, okay. But this happens, right? Especially with all the voice training you do. If you're a trans man, it's easy. The testosterone, within 3 months, it's done. But if you're a trans woman, it's a harder thing. You got to make more of an effort. Most people don't realize the effort that it takes. And a lot of these kids think, oh, it's funny. It's candy in a candy store. What you were talking about, well, what do I need a doctor for? I just want, you know, hormones and surgery. That's called the embodiment movement today, where people want to have a penis and a vagina, that kind of thing. And they think they should go. They can go into any doctor and just ask for that. Now, there are disreputable physicians. I don't know what there was no diagnostic code, really, when I remember some of my female friends in high school in the 60s went in for their first rhinoplasty, when rhinoplasty became a thing back in the 60s. What was the diagnosis then? I think the diagnostic code, because there always had to be a code, because nothing matters more in medicine than billing codes, but much more than diagnostics, prognosis, imaging, any of that stuff. So there was a code. So what would it be like? Status post deviated septum. I think that's what they all had. Now, I was 16 at the time. I wasn't into that at that point. But looking back on it, yeah, that's probably what it was. They needed something, so they made up something. And the profession didn't really care, and the insurers didn't care because insurers weren't covering it because it was a cosmetic surgery. Now, we knew that. If this was all going to be cosmetic surgery, and we all paid for it back in the day before any insurer covered it, right? And if that's the way it was going to be, then it really didn't matter. So the battle between, back as you described it, back in 2009, when we sat down to rewrite gender identity disorder, was between the people who simply were offended by being considered as having a psychiatric disorder, like you and I just never believed that. My whole life was predicated on convincing people that I wasn't psychotic, right? And that this was an intersex condition. Yeah, it changes the definition of intersex a little bit, but fundamentally, it's what intersex is. Female brain, male genitals, vice versa, stuff like that. You just need to understand that. And the more we learned about human sexual development and genetics and stuff too, the more it was evident. And we have now 30 years, three decades worth of neuroscience, of cognitive neuroscientific literature showing that transsexual people exist. We don't have an MRI yet that has quite the resolution to be able to in vivo test anybody who comes in and says, I'm trans, but that day is coming. I wish it was already here. Of course, the queers would get, oh, you're not going to put me in a cylinder like that and zap me with that stuff, because they know they'd be outed as not being transsexual. But we have enough posthumous, right, neuropathology that shows that trans men are trans men in certain nuclei, trans women. And all I've been making the case is sex is binary. We have a brain sex because we're a sexually dimorphic species, just the way we have different genitalia, different reproductive systems, et cetera. All of our organs, for the most part, are sexually dimorphic. That's just the way it is. And trying to deny that, which the queers do, they erase sex, they erase biology completely, is part of the campaign to undermine sex so that you can be the gender that you want. And this goes back to the founding of America. The problem is the two main principles that define America from the Declaration of Independence are liberty and equality. But you cannot have just liberty, and you cannot have just equality. Your liberty ends at the tip of my nose. That's the classic slogan, the cliche for that. So you can be, as I was implying before, that you can be a gay man and you can be into leather. Your friends could know that and you could talk about it, but you'd be crazy to go into the political arena and say, I want rights for leather gays, right? We never did that. We wanted gay rights for all gays, and what they do in the bedroom or in their parties and stuff, that's irrelevant. That's nobody's business, right? That's the whole point of it. It's nobody's business. What the trans community is doing, what the queer trans, I call them QT, Andrew would call them QT++. I wrote an op-ed for the Times and the Atlantic and the Wall Street Journal, all those, 2 years ago, called How Queer is Killing Trans. And John Rauch helped me pass it around and try to get me published and stuff. And in 2023, nobody was ready for that. When Nick came by and said, you know, I'd like to understand what happened here and everything. And I said, okay, well, I'll give you the history. The problem is that the queers aren't doing this for themselves, other than maybe dealing with their anxiety, their depression, their autism, or their narcissism, what have you. They're doing it because they want to force others to abide by their identity and their desires and their behavior. We never did that. I never demanded that somebody not misgender me. Now, I was fortunate. I was rarely misgendered, but I would explain things to people. I would educate them. I was a teacher and a professional, and then I would persuade them. And I persuaded some of the most homophobic legislators that I've ever come across who, for religious reasons, believe that men shouldn't be marrying men and women shouldn't be marrying women. But it would then say, well, Dana, you made your case to me. This is a medical condition. So, of course, why in the world would I discriminate against you? This is how you build, right, political power and how you get stuff done. They're not interested in that. This is more of a kneel before Zod moment. If I tell you that I am, have to recognize me as I am, I'm a turtle, you know, and I identify as a tree and I use it and that pronouns and stuff, you must appreciate that and use that. I demand that you do that. We never did that. Transsexuals never did that. We just wanted to live our lives like our sisters and our brothers. We never demanded that of anybody.
You mentioned it earlier about the individuals making $200,000 to $300,000 a year and claiming to be on the receiving end any moment of a genocide. At the success rate of being able to have, for example, the city of New York enforce laws about not using wrong pronouns for a person where you could be fined. They've been quite successful. I'm not exactly sure why. You're right. The idea is not to situate us within society to completely disrupt or deconstruct or dismantle society as a norm, family as a norm, the idea of sex as a norm, right?
Right. Okay, so this is important. This is important. So going back to what happened, queerness is a function or basically a sub-function of postmodernism. I've been studying postmodernism stuff for 50 years now, since college, basically. Started with Foucault and structuralism and post-structuralism and reader response and then deconstruction, Derrida's deconstruction, which is the classic with, as far as language goes. And then women's rights and gay rights and queer rights and gender rights, all that stuff. They're all part of the same thing. And the underlying thesis is that language is not fixed. Language means whatever you say it means. You can deconstruct language. You can invert it, subvert it. You can play games with it. And it's really a lot of fun to do that when you're standing back and playing a game, right? Like playing pickleball or hockey, something like that. It can be a lot of fun until you get injured. And then it's not so much fun if you break your toe, as your colleague there knows about. So, but that's the whole point of postmodernism. There is no absolute truth. Now, we can argue that there might not be absolute truth, but science is about moving forward to try to get closer to the truth asymptotically all the time. We want to get as close to that as possible. We understand probably we'll never get there. It's like God and religion. You can't really connect. You do the best that you can. So by undermining the language, by pulling the rug out from under the language, you create self-ID where anybody can claim to be trans. The most ridiculous thing these days is all the male cross-dressers who were very happy to just sort of hang on the side, go to Southern Comfort conferences and party with us while they were on FOM. And, you know, we were trying to get surgeons and stuff set up for patients and do all that, and to move forward on the legal and legislative agendas that we had. And the cross-dressers were just having a good time. Now, most of the quote-unquote trans women that are out there are nothing more than cross-dressers, or they are, you know, murderous, cannibalistic criminals who, after they are convicted, say, oh, but I'm a woman, I need to go to a woman's prison. And Scotland started that, and then Britain did it, and Canada does it now all the time. And it even happens in this country. Now, you ask, why does that happen? Well, I think it's because those places where it happens are run by Democrats, and the Democratic Party is run by the radical left now. They're the only ones who speak out. And if you were to raise your voice, even in a whisper, they would cancel you. Just, you know, we don't have too much time here, for lack of a better term, and you had to shut up or you'd lose your job or your life would be ruined. Now, you're talking about New York City and the pronouns and stuff. I happen to know people in businesses who will not hire anybody who has they, them pronouns or something like that, because they know that's a lawsuit, you know, just waiting to happen.
We are going to take our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Dr. Dana Beyer, who discusses the broader aspects of Nick Confessori's essay in the New York Times. We are grateful to our sponsors who sponsor this show, and grateful to UK Health Radio for airing this platform. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle, and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tenna Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tenna Sensitive Care Pads with the skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kag. Our guest this hour is Dr. Dana Beyer, who discusses the broader aspect of Nick Confessori's essay in the New York Times. Let's get back to our show.
And they don't want to put up with it. You're not going to come into my business and tell me what I need to do. Again, that's the liberty and equality. You can be whomever you want. I don't care. I don't care if any adult wants to transition. They can have a penis and a vagina. I don't care about that. But that's not my problem. If my not accepting that and treating you like a normal person, because you're not normal, normal in the statistical definition, you're not normal, triggers you and makes you uncomfortable, that's your problem. That's not my problem. You have the right to be and think of yourself as whoever you may think you are. And I have my feelings and you have your feelings, but you have no right to impose those on others. One of the most bizarre things, and much of Nick's article was about the Scrimeti decision, right, in the Supreme Court, and about Chase Strangio, who is a perfect example of somebody called nominative determinism, where the name Strangio, chasing strangeness, and okay, you know, that's weird that he would choose that name. I don't know where that came from. But Chase, and I've known Chase for 8 years now, Chase hates the Constitution. He hates the American Constitution. He thinks the Supreme Court is vile. He hates marriage. He hates marriage equality. He opposed the Federal Marriage Equality Act because he hates marriage, period. He thinks the law, he's a lawyer, he thinks the law is an oppressive tool of violence. This is the most radical left-wing Marxist stuff that's not even postmodern, it's modernist, that's out there. And yet he was the guy arguing in front of SCOTUS. The ACLU had to allow him to do that. They couldn't fire him. They still can't fire him. Now, Anthony Romero, the president of the ACLU, or whatever the term is for that, he seems to believe in this stuff. But the LGBT subgroups, they're not thrilled with Chase. But if they fire him for incompetence or something, he'll sue them. And this, everybody knows this, and so that's just the way it is.
Dana, would you say he's right up there with Dean Spade?
Well, yeah, you know what? I didn't know whether you guys really remember Dean Spade. I remember Dean Spade from the aughts. Dean Spade was the Chase Strangio of the aughts with the Sylvia Rivera Law Project. And we had to deal with that at the time, too. And for the most part, you're busy doing your job. I was doing the medical part of this, and then I got involved with WPATH, and then redoing the DSM and such on a committee here in DC that was writing the text for the new gender dysphoria diagnosis and such. And I knew that Dean Spade was out there. And I go, well, America's a big place and everybody's entitled to their opinions. And Dean ran a clinic. And I think Dean did some good for some people, right? Because there were a lot of poor trans people out on the street and they needed help. And Dean was there to do it. But when you allow that ideology start permeating the core of, say, the Democratic Party, then you're running into trouble because then you're going to lose people. So when you are politically speaking, and it amazes me how many former colleagues and allies in the gay rights movement and the trans rights movement that I had that have bought into all of this, even though they know they're on the 20% side of the 20-80 distinction in polling in America, like on boys and girls sports and stuff. And yet they refuse to break on that. Although I just saw something before we came on here that Mayor Pete has said that he doesn't quite think it's fair that boys should participate in girls' sports. I didn't read it, so that's just a headline. I apologize if I'm wrong on that, but maybe the ice is beginning to break. But you're not going to win elections, basically, if you're taking the 20% side of 80%. You might win in a particular district. AOC might win in the Bronx and in Queens. Mamdani might win in New York and destroy New York City as a Bolshevik jihadi. But you're not going to win in America. You're not going to win, take over Congress. You're not going to win the Senate. You're not going to win in the presidency if you take more and more extreme positions that most people don't abide by. And that's the queerness part of it. And I have to say, as a physician, that I'm appalled that the transsexual kids that are out there who should be given a choice. Now, we know now because Marcy Bowers, who's a good friend of mine and my surgeon as well, has admitted publicly that when you put an 11-year-old on puberty blockers, they may very well never have any sexual function, no ability to orgasm whatsoever. And we know they're not going to be fertile at all. So they're giving up their reproductive future and their sexual future.
Dana, I think you did a really good job of giving us this much larger view historically and socially based on your involvement and just what you've done and who you know. And so I think you did a really good job of showing us when you're responding to Nick's question of how did this happen? I think you did a really good job of that. I'm with you 100%. I think On is as well. Now, what do? We've got to turn this around. We've got to take back the language. We've got to take back the movement, something. We've got to do something. We can't solve that right here, right now, because we're at the end of our time together. But it's been so wonderful to have you on to hear all of that backstory. And I just want to say thank you, transsexual to transsexual. Just thank you. Thank you for, you've been in the community much longer than I have. You had much more influence than I've ever had because of the world that you ran in just as a professional and being able to be with these larger organizations. So I want to say thank you because you did what you needed to do to keep the road paved. It's not always a good thing when the road diverts and you take, it's not always a good thing. It used to sound like a wonderful thing. Trying to figure out what path you're going to go on is not just a literary inquiry anymore. And so to wrap up really quickly, do you have anything coming up that you'd like to let our listener know about? Anything that you're going to be doing? Is there a website where people can go and read more about your thoughts on this? Can they read that op-ed that never got published? Have you put it up somewhere that is accessible to people?
Again, as I said, I was looking forward to retiring and I wanted to be completely retired. I've been working under the table now for the last 4 years on these issues. People would reach out to me and ask for my advice and consult. I'm hoping to publish that essay. I mean, nothing's really changed except I think we're past the peak insanity. I'm hoping that the next article that gets written, say in 6 months, has more people willing to be named in the story. In that story, it was just Brianna and I who were actually named as transsexual people. And I found that very unfortunate. He spoke to a lot of people. They were all anonymous. You need the courage. We need to, when asked, you're doing your thing. Andrew Sullivan's doing his thing. There are a whole bunch more. John Rauch does his thing. I do my thing. I don't shy away from it. And I don't care if somebody uses my name, but I'm not out there trying to lead on this because, again, I don't think the post-war generation should be leading on this.
We have come to the end of the Umbrella Hour. You've been listening to Dr. Dana Beyer. We hope that you enjoyed this hour. We wish you all a happy holiday season. Thank you for listening. Until next time.